anybody. Anybody with any trouble, go to Palestine and see what trouble really is.
The elderly carry the keys to their demolished houses round their necks, and the new generation educate their children on the 1948 land grab that forced out hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. This art exhibition in London is part of their ongoing struggle to raise the flag for Palestine.
I'm here today to celebrate our Palestinian culture, our amazing Palestinian artists. You know, our people are talented, clearly, and it's so nice to see them use their talents to preserve our culture.
This exhibition is called Visualizing Return. It launched on the anniversary of UN Resolution 194, which calls for the immediate return of all Palestinian refugees. Visualizing Return hopes to emphasize the necessity of granting Palestinian refugees this long overdue human right.
Interestingly enough, one of the easiest citizenships to acquire is Israeli citizenship. All you have to do is to prove that you have a Jewish grandparent or a Jewish spouse. But there is a Palestinian diaspora 6 million strong, and they are not allowed to return to their homeland.
The Israeli regime wants to maintain a Jewish majority. If the diaspora were allowed to return, they would by far outnumber the Jewish population. So 73 years into occupation, the demographic war rages on. Exiled Palestinians are raising awareness, but on the front line of this struggle are the men, women and children holed up in the largest open-air prison in the world, the Gaza Strip. Bianca Rahimi, London.
In its latest annual report, Italy's Center for Social Studies and Policies, CENSIS, has found that some 2 million Italian families were in absolute poverty in 2020, a rise of more than 100% on 2010. This is due to the outbreak of COVID-19 that has accentuated a sense of vulnerability in the country. Census report shows that over 40% of Italians feel insecure, while students suffer increasing levels of depression, anxiety and existential angst.
The COVID-19 pandemic has made more workers vulnerable to pay discrimination, loss of income and exploitative practices. The socioeconomic malaise, which was already worrying before the pandemic, is today very much widespread to all layers of the population.
The company we work for refuses to meet us to discuss the terms of our contract as the pandemic is completely changing the way we work. This is unacceptable.
Over the past months, hundreds of large and smaller protests have been staged across Italy with workers from both the public and private sectors expressing deep concern over their deteriorating rights situation. On Friday in Rome, employees from Sogei, the information and communication technology company of the Ministry of the Economy and Finance, held a demonstration demanding to negotiate new smart working guidelines with the employer. Also on Friday, farmers from an area north of Naples staged a protest near the Agriculture Ministry calling the government for financial assistance. Hundreds of small farming companies have gone bankrupt as the large-scale retail trade has preempted small entrepreneurs.
We haven't been allowed to be here in big numbers due to the COVID restrictions. The government must help us. We are asked to observe the most stringent food regulations when it comes to our products, but fruit and vegetables full of pesticides coming from Morocco and other countries are let in without controls. Furthermore, we haven't received a penny from the EU aid funds to farmers. When the money lands into the regional government's account, it simply disappears.
On Friday, Rome and Milan were both affected by a public transport four-hour strike called by the General Union of Labour, UGL. The nationwide action was called by unionists against the obligation for workers to have the Green Pass, a certificate proving the older has been vaccinated, tested negative or recovered from COVID-19. Max Civili, Rome.
Abdullah Al-Ghamdi is a Saudi rights campaigner living thousands of miles away from home. But even here, he isn't safe from tactics used by the Saudi regime to silence dissenters.
They attack my mom and my little brother in Jeddah. In the same time, they attack my father and another brother in Dammam. My brother in Dammam, they take him for 3 years. Nobody knows where is he. But after three weeks, they release him, but they ask him to talk about me.
Abdullah and fellow rights campaigners are trustees of London-based human rights organization Sanad. Here at a press conference ahead of releasing their first report on Saudi rights abuses titled I Fear for My Mother, compatriot Fahd Al-Ghawaidi has experienced the heavy hand of the Saudi regime more than once.
Believe it or not, I was selling books on the street. And the Saudi regime back then was, until now, he was, the knowledge is forbidden for the people in Saudi Arabia.
Another dissident had an entirely different experience. Journalist Jamal Khashoggi, killed at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey in 2018 to send a chilling message. Yet these campaigners say the murder has redoubled their resolve.
Jamal Khashoggi is dead now, but the idea of Jamal Khashoggi is still alive, and it will be alive and remembered in our minds and in our heart forever.
The activists here say that the hopes of real reform in Saudi Arabia under the current regime are slim. That what is needed is real radical change, a revolution, and that's exactly what the current regime in Saudi Arabia cannot stomach.
They also believe the royals of Riyadh would not be able to maintain their human rights abuses without the support of Western governments, including the UK, a major supplier of weapons to Saudi Arabia.
Politicians pursue monetary and other personal interests, and in doing so, they overlook human rights abuses, even when it comes to matters which go against their own principles, such as freedom of speech and of expression.
To Abdullah and his fellow campaigners, the road to real reform in Saudi Arabia is a tedious one, but they say they won't relent. They say they're motivated by the words of Nelson Mandela. It always seems impossible until it's done. Saipur is up, London.
The President of the Shura Council and the Deputy Speaker of the House of Representatives in the Saudi-backed Hadi regime admitted that the regime has turned its back to Yemeni people and accused the Saudi-led coalition of causing a humanitarian crisis for the whole nation.
The statements by the officials in the Hadi regime clearly show that the war is not the solution to the current problem in Yemen, and the country needs a political solution. The statements also reveal the constructive role of the Ansarullah group in the fight against the Saudi-led coalition. There is a growing public call for an end to the war in Yemen.
The Deputy Minister of Information in Sana'a, Nasruddin Amir, said these statements came in the right direction, and Sana'a encourages taking such stances against the Saudi-led coalition, even if they do not have a direct impact on the battle.
We welcome any protests within the Saudi-led coalition. These protests show the true nature of the coalition and come in the right direction. We know that this is the U.S. who is leading the war on Yemen.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen on March 2015 to return their protege, exiled former President Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi, to power. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children, and pushed the country to the brink of famine.
For 7 years now, Saudi Arabia has failed to achieve any of its announced goals in the beginning of the war. Observers say Riyadh should start looking for other means, including a political solution, to get rid of the quagmire it's stuck with its war on Yemen, since the Yemeni army has proven that it is now a real threat to the kingdom more than ever. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As the winter draws near, relief materials starts pouring in for destitute Rohingya refugees in India. But urge for schooling and educational material for their children is their biggest worry. Despite the UN conventions on the rights of child, irrespective of nationality, faith or ethnicity, the majority of Rohingya children continue to be deprived of any formal education, therefore threatening their future.
We have faced all the odds and miseries of this world, but we appeal to the world community not to ignore our generations and do everything possible to help us educate our children.
Several thousand Rohingya Muslims have been camping in parts of India for more than a decade, with nothing more to share rather than horrid tales of violent past. In almost all refugee camps, children would usually be seen spending time in dirt and filth, raising fears of disease and infections across the camps. Nevertheless, nobody cares, including them. This man says anxiously, we will fight with life as long as we can, but the future worry of our children might kill us silently.
We have been living here in peace since the last 9 years. Never faced any troubles, but now things look very challenging. India gave us hope of new life. We want to stay alive for our children, lest we have no hope left.
Regardless of refugee crisis the world has witnessed since last decade, this particular community continues to be unseen victims of violence, yet ignored or perhaps abandoned. Estimates suggest more than 40,000 Rohingya refugees live in India after fleeing a brutal crackdown in Myanmar. The UN refugee agency responsible to support them is of insignificant help, they say. Rights activists have time and again appealed to the Indian government to lend all possible support to the community, despite the fact they face threat to life back in Myanmar. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh, but it never endorsed any framework to safeguard the interests of these refugees. Now calls are growing for concrete refugee policy, irrespective of political agenda, faith, or ethnicity.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin met with South Korean Minister of Defense Suk Thursday. The two counterparts agreed to develop new operational plans to deal with what Austin described as North Korea's destabilizing behavior.
The United States and the ROK remain committed to a diplomatic approach to the DPRK, and we continue to call upon the DPRK to engage in dialogue. But we also discuss measures to enhance our combined deterrence posture and to defend against the full range of threats.
Missile and nuclear programs. South Korea wants to see sanctions suspended and an official declaration to end the Korean War, two items apparently not near the top of the military chief's agenda. Meanwhile, outside South Korea's Ministry of National Defense, activists called for Seoul to disentangle itself from an alliance with the U.S. and take control of its own national defense.
South Korean armed forces and military resources are likely to be dragged into U.S. Indo-Pacific strategies. We came here to denounce it and to deliver this message to the American authorities. The U.S. should return wartime operational control immediately.
Austin also called out China over its military buildup, as Washington now plans to move more forces, an attack helicopter squadron, and an artillery division headquarters to be stationed in South Korea.
The meeting here between the leaders of the U.S. and the South Korean militaries comes following the release of the Pentagon's 2021 Global Posture Review. The U.S. will now place even more emphasis on deterring China and North Korea, with Washington calling for more help from its allies. Frank Smith, Seoul.
You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
the supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
In what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, how long does it take for members of the so-called international community to forget about a ruler ordering the murder of a journalist, a crime which was so blatant that it took place in a consulate in a foreign country, and the murderers cut the journalist into pieces and discarded the remains? It appears 3 years is enough time for French President Emmanuel Macron to forget what happened to Saudi dissident and journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. And according to the CIA, he was killed by henchmen on the direct orders of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, the man Macron is in Saudi Arabia to see. What does it all mean? Stay with us as we take a look at this on the Spotlight.
French President Emmanuel Macron met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the Saudi city of Jeddah and discussed a whole range of issues, including crisis at Lebanon, which has been suffering from economic hardships for the past several years. Macron's visit to Saudi Arabia is overshadowed by the 2018 assassination of Saudi critic and journalist Jamal Khashoggi. American intelligence agencies have concluded that the murder was directly ordered by Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS. The visit has drawn reactions from human rights groups. They accused the French president of trying to, quote, rehabilitate MBS. Critics argue that nothing can justify Macron's trip given Saudi Arabia's human rights violations.
Whatever strategic interest France has in Saudi Arabia, nothing can justify their legitimization of a ruler who kills journalists, threatens activists, imprisons women human rights defenders, slaughters Yemeni civilians, and deceives the international community. Macron diminishes himself and his country as he stoops to partnership with MBS.
Macron has rejected the accusations, claiming that the dialogue with Saudi Arabia was necessary to work for stability in the region. The visit is part of the two-day tour to the Persian Gulf that earlier took Macron to the UAE and Qatar. In the UAE, he signed a record $15.8 billion contract for selling 80 French Rafale warplanes. Rights bodies again came out vocal about the sale. They criticized the agreement, blaming the Emiratis for playing a prominent role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. Signing a major weapons deal with a country involved in the war on Yemen raises speculations as to what exactly Paris is looking for in such trips. Such a sale is especially under the spotlight at a time when France has been deprived of a share in a lucrative security pact among Australia, the UK, and the US. That, along with the fact that France is one of the largest weapons exported to Saudi Arabia, brings one to the conclusion that France is only after selling its military hardware, despite the war crimes Riyadh has committed and the irreparable loss of hundreds of thousands of civilian lives during the ongoing war on Yemen.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman out of Washington, D.C. And the director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me. I'm going to start this off in Washington. And Michael, what do you make of Macron's visit at this time?
Well, Macron, as one African journalist terms him, the cookie monster, given that his name is similar to the French cookie, Macron, has delusions of grandeur. He wants to reestablish France as a world power. And he has pressured the Lebanese government to have their information minister resign after he had dared to criticize the Saudi war in Yemen. I think that Macron wants to sell more weapons, just like the British and the French do to the region. And there's certainly far too many weapons there now. And he wants to make up, as your commentator said earlier, for the loss of the a submarine contract with Australia. I think that Macron is tied up with some rather unsavory characters like Mohammed bin Salman, who is, as your commentator said, is a essentially a repulsive and repressive despot who doesn't flinch at murder, at capturing people who are dissidents from other countries and jailing them. So I think that Macron should stay home and keep his mouth shut and work to get the foreign soldiers out of the region, like the Americans and other countries.
Well, Zafar, do you think that with his visit, Macron is basically giving a nod to his Western counterparts that the minor reprimand of not visiting Saudi Arabia via official delegations is now over?
Yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, most Western governments do not really care about human rights. Their overriding concern is to promote their economic interests, and in particular, weapons sales to a region that is already awash with billions of dollars worth of weapons that are being used against innocent people. We know both Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have been involved in this brutal war against Yemen since March of 2015. Where, according to the United Nations' own estimates, several hundred thousand people have been killed. Also, Saudi Arabia is involved in destabilizing Lebanon. It has sent mercenaries into Syria and Iraq. And the UAE also, which is a partner in crime with the Saudis in Yemen, these new weapons that they have purchased, which obviously will be supplied by the year 2027. But it clearly indicates that as far as Macron is concerned and other Western rulers, they don't care about human rights. They basically only are interested in promoting their own interests. And if there is a government that stands up for its own rights, which is perceived as being contrary to the interests of these Western regimes, then of course these Western regimes trot out this argument of human rights. So I'm afraid this latest deal is going to further destabilize the region. It is not going to do anything for the people of the region.
Michael, how do you see it? I mean, is that the overall goal? You heard Zafar just now talk about that he's afraid that it's going to destabilize the region even more. Is that what it's all about? I mean, with these Western governments that claim that they believe in human rights and democracy and spreading it all over, but is it basically to keep these regions, specifically this region, destabilized? We see the unbelievable amount of weapons and military equipment sold in this region for them to basically get higher profit from the region, or your assessment of it all? What is it all about to you?
Well, my assessment is, just like the gentleman from Canada said, that the outside powers in the United States and in Europe let the region destabilize so they can sell them weapons, so that they can ensure that Israel does not have any opposition of any meaningful strength and power, and that they can do as they will. They can offer deals to various government officials to do their bidding, money, visas, their students in Harvard University or someplace else in the United States or Canada or Europe. So the advantage is to keep the pot boiling, to have a reason for being in there, claiming that we need to help stabilize the region. That's why our soldiers, sailors, and Marines are there. And they don't look to the bigger picture of what is being done to Yemen, what is being done to Lebanon, what is being done to Iraq or Syria. They don't see the attacks on Iran. They whine and they complain that the Iranians are not negotiating in good faith in Vienna, even though the Americans...
Well, Michael, is it that they don't see? Sorry to interrupt you. Is it that they don't see, or is it that they just basically don't care?
They see and they don't care. They see this as a means of emphasizing their ability to posture, to say that, yes, we are all for all this and that and the other thing. But we need to be in there, and we need to have close contact with scumbags like Mohammed bin Salman or other creatures in the area. and that it's to their advantage. They look good, they sound good, and nobody questions what's really behind the rhetoric and hot air.
Okay, well, Zafar, we look at, of course, Macron was, he not only went to Saudi Arabia, but also Qatar and the UAE. The UAE, he finalized a deal selling 80 fighter jets to this speck of a country, basically, if we want to say. What do you make of this? It's quite unbelievable. It's amazing that the world is not in outrage, like, why would this little country need 80 more fighter jets and not realizing the importance, the role of this place in destabilizing it even more. I'm saying, why isn't the rest of the world just not in outrage over this?
Well, essentially, much of the world, and when we talk about the world, we are talking essentially about Western powers, it is in their interest not to worry about the destabilizing effects of the policies of their allies. And what happens to the people of the region is something that they don't care about. We also need to keep in mind that the UAE is simply not capable. They do not have the wherewithal to be able to fly these planes. In fact, I can predict right from now that they will probably need to hire foreign pilots, most probably from Pakistan or Jordan or Egypt, to fly these planes for them. And of course, the French would make tons of money by sending their technicians that would supposedly maintain these this hardware that is going to be supplied to the United Arab Emirates. Unfortunately, the United Arab Emirates is punching way above its weight. It's a tiny country, it has a tiny population, and the majority of the population in the UAE is in fact foreigners. They can't even do much of the work themselves. So what we are witnessing is a situation whereby the UAE is being encouraged by these massive weapons purchases to become even more unruly. We know that the UAE has been involved in Libya, it was involved in Syria. It was even accused by Turkey of having its hand in the July 2016 coup. So we see that this tiny country, this speck of a country, is actually punching way above its weight, and it is likely to find some times ahead if it tries to grapple and chew too much, because it won't be able to swallow it. Of course, we also see that the UAE is going headlong with its so-called normalization with the Zionist regime in occupied Palestine. And again, I can foresee that the UAE is going to lose because they're not going to be able to hoodwink the Zionists to benefit the people or the government of the United Arab Emirates.
Michael, your perspective, how much Zafar said, the Zionist regime play in all of this? On the one hand, we have these Western countries and wanting to make their own profits and keeping it destabilized. But how much is it also trying to keep the area destabilized? One, because it benefits Israel, and two, also, how much does it play into trying to control and pressure the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Well, I think that's entirely correct. The Israelis, the apartheid entity, are deeply involved in trying to split the Arab world, buddying up to the Gulf states, essentially lines on a map, and improving relations with the Saudis, of course, is in keeping with the repressive nature of Israel and its efforts to destroy its neighbors repeatedly since its illegitimate creation. The Israelis have been having a fine time selling their spyware around the world, and they've even managed to sell it, I guess, to the Ugandans so they could spy on the American embassy there. That's just been a major issue. The Israelis work and dangle carrots of money and investment and travel and trade and things like this to the Arab world to make them forget all about the Palestinians and what's been done to them, and to gain allies and to ensure a monolith opposed to Iran, which is Israel's real enemy besides the United States. As long as they can do this, they're happy, they're making money, they're acquiring information, they are gaining a hand in the operation of the governments of these various countries in the region. So it's all to their benefit that they destabilize the area and make a profit out of it.
Safar, how complicit do you see these Western governments in Saudi and UAE crimes that have taken place? I mean, you talked about a couple of them before, whether we're talking about Syria or we're talking about Libya or we're talking about Yemen. I mean, how complicit are these entities themselves for selling these type of weapons, for supporting, even giving air support sometimes to these regimes in these different countries?
I think the Western complicity is absolutely obvious. Let us begin with reviewing the Saudi-led war on Yemen, which was announced in the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C. on March 26, 2015. Now, you would think that a country that is going to wage war on another country, they would make that announcement in their own capital city, their own government would be making those decisions, and yet that decision was made from the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C. So that's a clear indication that the Americans had given the green light to the Saudis and their so-called allies to proceed with that war crime to attack the people of Yemen. And, of course, we know that the Americans provide logistical support to the Saudis. The British are involved. The French are involved. They are basically even selecting targets for the Saudis to bomb. But, of course, the Saudis are so incompetent that they often miss those targets, and instead they have been killing civilians. They have destroyed civilian infrastructure, whether it is hospitals, schools, warehouses where grain is kept, and other facilities. So when we look at the Saudi-led war in Yemen, obviously the Western governments are fully involved and fully complicit. And this extends, of course, all across the region. When we look at Syria, the United States still has its forces in Syria illegally occupying a part of Syria when the Syrian government has not given it permission to station its forces over there. The Americans have been basically supporting Daesh terrorists, and there is ample proof of that, that it was the Americans that created this monstrous group so that it would destabilize these governments, whether it is in Syria or in Iraq. Of course, in Iraq, Daesh has been defeated thanks to the efforts of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and in particular, General Qasem Soleimani, the martyr, who was martyred because he was so successful against these terrorist groups. And even now, the Americans have their forces in Iraq, and although an agreement was signed that these forces would be pulled out by the end of 2021, and yet the Americans are simply going to change their designation and say that, well, now they are not going to be involved in a combat mission, they are only going to be involved in training the Iraqi army, and so they will still continue to stay over there. So in terms of Western complicity, I don't think that there is any doubt. The Western governments are completely complicit in the crimes that are being committed in that region against innocent people. Regrettably, we don't have an international order in which these real war criminals can be brought to justice. And that is why the people are then left with no choice but to rise up and resist these criminal forces, just as it's happening in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, etc.
So, Michael, on the one hand, we have the what Zafar talks about is the Western complicity. On the other hand, there seems to be this strange competition between these Western countries. It's as if they are so desperate financially, economically, to see who can sell the most at any cost. I mean, the combination just creates total chaos in the region. Your take on this, what can be done?
Well, unfortunately, nothing much can be done because, for example, in the United States, the sales to these countries of various sorts of weapons is really big business. Joe Biden, who campaigned on the basis of, oh, we're opposed to the war in Yemen, is selling $650 million worth of missiles to the Saudi Air Force. So it's say one thing and do another. And unfortunately, the people themselves in the United States and in Europe simply go along with this. They're more concerned with the virus and who's got which variant of the virus. They are concerned with keeping their jobs or getting a better job. They're people that don't associate with others because they might get the virus and therefore don't have time to read the newspaper if there is, in fact, any news in it. I was in Missoula, Montana for a week, and the local paper, the Missoulian, is basically half sports and half local news on the front page. So there's no real interest, there's no real information coming to anyone outside of what comes to the main news media, which simply parrots the government line. Basically, it comes down to nobody knows anything, nobody wants to do anything, and nobody cares.
And Zafar, Michael talked about the American people. What about the people of the region? Do you see them more and more as separating from their dictatorial rulers, becoming more and more aware of how basically they've been used and played by their regime leaders and sold out to create basically this instability and to steal their natural resources?
Well, there are different categories. For instance, when we look at Yemen, the people of Yemen, of course, have risen up. Similarly, the people of Syria against these foreign aggressors, and to some extent in Iraq. Unfortunately, in regimes like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, people have been led on this hedonistic path. While we speak, for instance, there in Saudi Arabia, there are massive concerts going on in which the people are being moved into this culture of pop music and dance and etc. And in other words, people are being entangled in vulgarity so that the people's attention would be moved away from what the regime is doing. But I'm afraid they would not last too long. I think there are rumblings of revolt, and ultimately these regimes would be consigned to the dustbin of history, as a number of other regimes were 10 years ago. So I think it's just a matter of time before the reality catches up with these regimes and people rise up in a proper way and get rid of these corruptors that are oppressing their own people.
And the reality of time has caught up with us, too, and that brings us to the end of this program. I appreciate both of you being with me, author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman, out of Washington, D.C., director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bankash, out of Toronto. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Kettle whistling. Well, I think this is one of the relaxing sounds at home. Two teaspoons of loose tea in the teapot. Then hot water. Now I put the teapot on the kettle and let the tea be brewed up on a low burner stove. Nothing is more enjoyable than a calm home. One of the relaxing factors for a home is the architecture. Architecture is a type of art which has been of much importance since very past times. In the history of art, many buildings have been built around the world which shine like glittering gems. Today we are going to visit one of these buildings, Saray-e Roshan, located in the capital city of Tehran. Saray-e Roshan is the name of a beautiful building in Tehran which has attracted many visitors. The building was built in 1932. Regarding its history and architecture, this building is very valuable. Saray-e Roshan is one of the first commercial centers of old Tehran and is located in the middle of Nasser Khosrow Street near Marvi Ali. The architecture of Saray-e Roshan is inspired by Gothic architecture. This building was damaged after a period of time, but it was repaired beautifully by the well-known Iranian architect Kamran Safomanesh about three decades ago. In this building, the combination of Iranian and European elements of architecture are used. The decorations of pillars and statues of the building are inspired by Baroque architecture in Europe. Ahura Mazda design, which is the symbol of Achaemenid era, and the traditional tile works, which are the symbols of Islamic Iranian art, are used in this building. I am now at Nasser Khosrow Street. This street is one of the crowded streets of Tehran. It's not a long way to Saray-e Roshan, and I hope that my destination be less crowded so that you could hear my voice better. Thank you. am now next to Saroye Roshan. Here is one of the earliest commercial centers of old Tehran. This place used to be a busy place, yet today is not booming as before. Nowadays, Saroye Roshan consists of some shops and a big yard. There is a very big basement in this market, which is being used as a place for storing goods. Let me get a little closer to this structure in order to watch its beauties. I am now in front of the magnificent entrance of Saroye Roshan. The balconies and tall pillars of this mansion are among the aesthetic elements of this building. Oh, look. On top of the wall, there are statues of angels. How beautiful. Just beneath the statues of angels, which are the symbols of European architecture, there is Ahura Mazda design. And below it, there is a big window. And in front of the window, there is a beautiful balcony. Six windows are situated next to this window symmetrically. Over and below the windows are decorated with beautiful blue Iranian tiles. Oh, this building is very beautiful. Some of the designs in Saroye Roshan building include winged sun, winged bodies, column capitals with beautiful decorations, and colorful attractive designs, which I can hardly describe them. If you happen to travel to Tehran, surely visit Saroye Roshan and enjoy its beauties. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Good morning!
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.